All rights reserved. Steve Coleman and the Origami Vancast. I think I'm going to call this week's show "Please Listen," but in parentheses, I'll call it the Fentanyl Show. I'm going to talk a lot about marijuana and not very much about fentanyl here going forward, but I want people to understand really what fentanyl is, because when I was placed on it, I really had no idea. I mean, I know it might be a little bit different that it was a patch and everything after that was explained to me, but I had never heard of it before. This was before everything had blown up. It seemed like a reasonable thing to me, and I was in really, really extraordinary pain and had a very long history of being very reliable with drugs and with pain, with my pain clinic, which I had a very long relationship. Like I've said in some of the other shows, I was calling myself an extreme athlete is like being extremely generous, you know. It's like I was just from the area where Matt Hoffman is from, and occasionally, you know, got to ride with him in later years at his skate park or in the ramp inside, which was super cool. But I had absolutely no skills, and tore my body up, not even realizing that my body was damaged, I guess. Anyway, what I really want to say first and foremost to everyone that's gotten this far, there's like 80 people that's listened to three shows at this point, which to me is a great start. Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure it's all friends and family. Well, I know it's not all friends and family, so thank you. Anyway, really. Hopefully this will eventually get to people that need it, and I really think there's definitely something here. This show is meant to tell you just a little bit about how I ended up on fentanyl. Not the preceding, at that point, what was it, 15 years in building pain since the accident, slowly losing mobility, and just a general level of nerve pain that was untreated by anything. I could go on and on about, you know, surgeries that I saw when I lived in St. Louis and Oklahoma and then later on in New Hampshire, but that's not the point of this show. This show is fentanyl, which is after the neck fusion, which put me on a different trajectory of pain. But I was trying to make a living. And I think a lot of people that have had fentanyl, either once or even people that have taken it, like my friend Jen, who's going to be, I promise, in the next show. We just got to iron out some technical difficulties. No big deal. I wanted to do this fentanyl show. But she asks, you know, hey, how can you possibly have worked and done things on fentanyl all this time? And, you know, it's true, it's certainly valid. It took me a while to build up to it. It took me a while just to be able to stand and stuff. And so it was kind of like relearning to operate. It was an extremely heavy drug. But I had just gotten done, you know, trying to play with marijuana and hold a conversation, a technical conversation, high with 100 Ivy League PhDs at physical sciences, and I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but those guys are pretty—they're pretty clever. They make some good arguments. That's all I'm saying. For the most part, if they got that far, they are not stupid. So it's very difficult. to have a memory of a goldfish and, you know, try and build a rocket with one. So I probably didn't impress them very much. You know, I was trying to iron that out, and then ended my career there trying to figure out fentanyl. You know, but you got to do what you got to do to put food on the table. And they laid me off in a pretty unceremonious way that I, you know, still have just a little bit of... I mean, I don't blame them. I knew everything that was coming. I know the funding situation and everything else. This is not my first rodeo. But what I'm supposed to be telling you about is how I can even live on fentanyl. And, you know, you develop a tolerance to it slowly over the first couple of months. And, you know, I had to figure out how I was not going to sleep every night. It was really highly disturbing. Even, you know, when I came home that first Christmas, I had been on for maybe like 6 months. You know, it was, my mom saw what was going on because I had stayed at her house, at least partially. And she would come in, you know, every other night, and I would be just completely awake there watching TV at all hours of the night because I didn't get any sleep at all the first night. And then the second night, you know, the sleep was just so terrible. You know, eventually, in this episode, I learned to meditate, which is really just, you know, if a thought come into your mind, just throw it out. Think about nothing. Sometimes I'll say focus on your breathing or your heartbeat to help clear your mind. But yeah, I found that to be super duper helpful in lieu of sleep, because otherwise you can't live. It was tough. But the real answer to that question is, what is the alternative? And it's pretty bleak. So I try to make it work. So that's what this show is. And hey guys, I'm sorry to ramble so long. I will cut this down somehow. Thank you so much.
I lament the ignorance that's there around cannabis and fascia. It's like almost kind of unacceptable. I think it's a real example to our species of how careful we need to be with our policies, especially regarding our medication and our health. Yeah, all right. So look, I want to tell you about fentanyl. I had been having these increasing neurological symptoms as my neck was just locking down more and more, so that I believe what was happening is the fascia in my neck. This is my hypothesis, and I'm just going to explain these things and as I come to them, and eventually maybe you guys will begin to see sort of my sort of working theory of the way everything kind of has worked with me. So I believe that the fascia was getting hung up there, you know, at the base of my neck, and this was after the sedentary period the convalescence period after my neck fusion. You know, I tried to go back to work and everything a little bit too early, and then I ended up in a lot of pain, a whole lot, a very concerning amount of pain, and it never went away, and sort of the trajectory just got worse and worse from there. And so eventually I became extremely desperate. I was hurting really bad after convalescing or attempting to convalesce. I returned to work, and it was a really, really awful situation. Sequestration had set in, we weren't getting any funding, everybody was super cranky. You know, these are already, I'm around like 100 PhDs, like in a small area. It's like a university in a cage match. So, yeah, and I came from that, from a small company. So this is a tough situation for me to endure, like all the way around. was needing to work, you know, to catch programs up and really make progress, because I'm looking at our deadlines and I'm like, there's no way we're going to meet any of these things. You know, I need to be building lasers in like one day. So I pushed my body to do that sort of thing through the pain and everything else. And this has really been the theme of my whole life, really, if you look at it. And I used the pain medicines to do that, to be able to push my body to do that, even though it was detrimental to my health. And not just the use of the medicine, but the actual, you know, damage to my body, the actual damage to my mental state, to hurt myself for money. Is really what it boils down to, rather than to get better and heal. I think my body really resented it. But anyway, I became very desperate, and a friend of mine introduced me to someone that had a supply of, you know, high quality, you know, trustworthy medical grade cannabis. And, you know, I was given a good introduction of, like, here's, you know, like, 6 different strains to check out, and, you know, in reasonable quantities, and here's a few different ways that you can try consuming them. And I really appreciate, that person's input and their personal time with me. And I appreciate knowing them. So I tried to use it on my pain. You know, you can't, when you're under pain contract, you're not supposed to do that. But I wasn't ready to just, you know, I mean, I only tried this drug once and it made me super goofy. But so I was kind of, you know, experimenting with it. And I could get some pain relief out of it and I could sort of make it work. But it was super unstable and really, really unreliable compared to the pills. And I just could not endure the pain fluctuations that were coming. And then, you know, again, all the stress with work and everything. And I ended up in a level of pain that I can't really talk about live right now. But my pain doctor at that point, or my pain, she's actually a nurse practitioner. I've been saying pain doctor, but she's the nurse practitioner for a doctor that I have had for a very long time ago. He ended up needing to retire, but I just saw Kathy the whole time, and she was excellent, and you know, I think served me as well as the system could, and I appreciate her very much. I came in to see Kathy, and I was like, we've got to do something different, you know, than the Percocets that I'm on. And, you know, I knew that Valium would help me, and it always, always did. And it was really the muscle relaxer that I ever had, you know, and you only ever get it after surgery. They would just never give it to you otherwise. But it was the only thing that gave me any respite. So thank God, you know, she finally allowed me to get some of that, you know. And then she told me about fentanyl, and, you know, it's definitely strong. So, yeah, I got on the fentanyl and got into that whole thing that's described on LinkedIn. And that is, you know, how I tried to manage this pain that's so bad that, you know, I mean, you know, it's really, you can't really explain it to somebody, but it's a lot. It's something that it's hard to lift your eyes from. In the course of, so I'm the, you know, definitely the primary breadwinner, if not the sole breadwinner in my family at this time. And really, you know, living up here, my income is what supported us, but it supported us well. I make a lot of money, but it is a lot of pressure. And if I were to say get laid off from my job, which was about to happen, while I was even on fentanyl, trying to make things work, then we would be in a financially negative situation. And So I did everything that I could. You know, I tried as hard as I could to stay employed and to do a good job and to keep, you know, my standards high. And, oh, yeah, so I wanted to say this. So I take responsibility, you know, for anything that I did, high or not high, anywhere, any decisions that I made, anything like that. When you are a chronic pain patient, you are used to being under the influence of drugs. And, you know, while certainly fentanyl is definitely a crazy one to be on, I was very accustomed to being on opiates. And, I did some of my best work while I was on those medications, honestly. But that's just not a good thing. I'm definitely not telling you to go get high and do your best work. I'm telling you that I very much regret doing that. I seek to minimize my drug use, even down to my tea drinking. I seek to minimize my dependence on external chemicals, let's say. Anyway, that's just, you know, it's kind of my personal philosophy at this point, and I think, you know, it ought to be pretty understandable to everybody. I mean, these drugs that I've been on take a horrendous toll on your body. What Kathy told me was that, I wouldn't have any legal way to drive. And so for a while, I would get a ride down to my job. But I worked an hour south of town one way. Even if your spouse is otherwise unemployed, that's a lot. You know, that's 4 hours of driving for them every day. And it's a lot of, you know, a lot of wear and tear in your car. Where they do not stay down there. It sucked. It really sucked. So anyways, I got laid off from that job and ended up going to Turkey. We had already paid for the vacation, basically. It wasn't that enjoyable of a trip. There's definitely, you know, I think I've been 4 times, and that was the worst time. But still awesome. Still vacation. Still beats the hell out of work. At least I tried to tell myself that. It's kind of hard to be on vacation whenever you're laid off with, you know, no prospects in the fourth quarter. You know you're not getting hired in the fourth quarter. It's not going to happen. Paying for fentanyl out of your pocket. So, yeah. Honestly, I don't remember what I did with the fentanyl in Turkey. I believe I took, like, you know, I was going for 5 days, so that was like 2 patches, and I was like, you know, screw it, I'll risk it for 2 patches or whatever. I mean, it was like, you know, the patch I had on and 2 more patches, something like that, and a gamble, so maybe I took 3. If you haven't experienced these drugs, then it's, your observations are really not going to be helpful for you, and just like, you know, all these people that came up to me whenever I first came out with my story that are like, hey, I didn't know you were in chronic pain. And yeah, I mean, so that is the goal of the drugs, and my ability to take them is so that I can go out and earn a living just like a normal person. That is why we take the drugs, okay? And, you know, some people, having a doctorate, you know, I do primarily desk and, you know, certainly indoor, and, you know, a lot of my work is in a clean room, which is kind of its own sort of burden. It's definitely more physical than a normal desk job, but especially if you've got a bad neck. But, you know, in general, it's not much what I do. And so I really just couldn't see going on disability because I can't even do that. I mean, nah, I can do it. You know, I wrecked that motorcycle. I made those decisions. And even if I didn't, what else is there for me to do? You know, if I could sit around and play video games, why couldn't I, you know, sit around and write MATLAB code? So, you know, that's the way I look at it. And, that's not judgment on other people. I mean, I will pass judgment on other people if you want me to. But it's not, you know, what does my opinion matter? What I'm just telling you is why I did what I did. And that's these travel stories. Now, I was laid off like a week before I went to Turkey. And the day before they were going to owe me severance. So we went to Turkey and everything, and it wasn't awful. It was pretty bad, though. Come back, go through the winter. It's pretty bleak on fentanyl, New England winter. Running out of money. Entire household unemployed. I would say it could be difficult to get a job on fentanyl. You know, I would say it definitely probably limits your prospects, especially if you go telling people. So I didn't, obviously. But yeah, I got a job. I reached out to the CEO and yeah, did some good work at Terra Diode, I think. Did it quickly, you know, which is what they needed. But again, I think I, you know, I spent my body doing that. And honestly, you know, it was detrimental to me. But that's what fentanyl allowed. But I couldn't take the pain anymore, so I went to a bigger company where I thought I could, you know, it would be less intense. So that would be Cambridge. It was, you know, substantially less intense. You know, that was overall a good decision, but, you know, big companies come with their own frustrations. And one of the immediate ones was that I was, like, almost immediately shipped over to Europe indefinitely. So I'm going to tell this story, and I'm going to tell another story, and I'm already going to say for Turkey as well that, you know, I really mean absolutely no disrespect to anybody's country or culture, having come there under the influence, under the heavy influence of these, you know, opioids. I was putting food on the table for my family, and I think that most common people can understand that. You know, I just couldn't see myself giving up. I mean, it would be giving all the way up, and I couldn't let that happen yet. So anyways, I end up in Germany, at the rental desk, brand new Mercedes, is going to be my car. And, I don't know if you've ever been on the Autobahn before, but if at the rental counter, if you're also on fentanyl, I would definitely get the insurance. I had a picture until recently, I lost it in Washington, of me doing something. I believe it may have been 180 kilometers an hour that they limit the rental car, that they have a sticker on the windshield that tells you not to exceed that because the snow tires can only go that fast on the Autobahn. My friend that I was visiting, we were going to meet in Frankfurt, he had said, man, you know, you get in on the Autobahn, you've got to run it up to that speed at least. He's like, just, you can't even say you've been on the Autobahn if you haven't done that. So, you know, I guess I did. And that was between Dusseldorf and Frankfurt in an open section. Well, as open as the Autobahn gets in there. It's definitely not like America. But I had a great time seeing my friend. We hung out. Had a great time there in Frankfurt, and then I went back and you know, I stayed in very nice lodgings in Dusseldorf. thankfully, because I was kind of there on an extended, you know, indefinite trip, and I was really in a lot of pain. after all of that travel, and especially, you know, after going to see Mo and everything, it had taken such a toll on my body that I needed about 3 days in bed. I pretty much just ate out of the minibar for a few days and didn't even go down the stairs of this big castle that I was in. I have a friend that had just taken a job in that area, and a longtime friend named Matthias. And so we visited. He took me to his adopted hometown of Cologne. I think he may just consider that his hometown, honestly. I know he considers himself a Rhinelander, and he's lived there for many years. So we watched a football match in a local pub. I had some Kölsch beer, something I had always wanted to try my whole life. So that part of the trip, you know, was one of the good things that come from what I've done. And, you know, it was just good to see my two friends, Mo and Matthias, over there in Germany. You know, I'm glad that everything worked out that way. That's kind of the, when you get stuck on business travel, that's kind of indefinite, you know, and the other party isn't there, or has something come up or whatever that you're going to visit, whatever occurs. Sometimes these little things happen in life, and they're disruptive and they mess up other things, but you know, you get the good side of it. And I'm so thankful that I got to see those people then, because I haven't seen them since. So it was special. Anyway, I just wanted to say something about, you know, Matthias is one of my oldest friends, and he and Mo are some of the reasons why this podcast is on in Europe. And then I drove up to a different part of Germany, up the northern Rhineland, above Köln, in the coal country, and conducted some business, and took some pictures of a coal mine up there. It's very pretty. It's no longer in use, but I was told it was the world's prettiest coal mine. So you had to take pictures of that. I think I've lost those in Washington, too, this year. Before I went to see the coal mine, actually, but after I had finished my business, I was pulling out of their parking lot. And this is a good story because it shows you how stiff my neck was. There was a pole in a weird place there, and I marked it whenever I went inside. And I knew it was there when I was backing up. So I backed up really super slowly. I couldn't see out of any of my mirrors, any of my windows, with the mobility I had in my neck at all. Just couldn't. I would have to get on my knees and turn around and somehow still stick the pedal. So there was just no way. So I relied on the radar and the bumpers. And this old German lady watched me slowly back into this pole while those radars, you know, right between the middle of the two radars, like right perfect in a dead zone. And probably the shape of the pole had something to do with it and everything else. But yeah, I backed into it. Oh man, brand new Mercedes. It had like no kilometers on the clock at all. But then I went on to see the coal mine. You know, I'd gotten the insurance, so I just told them at the rental counter and went on. So some Mercedes were harmed in the making of this show. And then it was back down to Dusseldorf to catch a flight over to Exeter, England, in the far south of England. And it's an airport I've been to many times, and as I go to get on the plane, my flight's been canceled because of fog. So I had that really set off a chain of events that canceled a lot of reservations and things that I had to deal with, and most immediately I had to find a place to sleep in Dusseldorf, Germany. With a great deal of effort, actually, and some really terrible travel agent support, because of the time difference and everything. It was like 1 in the morning here in the States. I got a room long enough to catch my flight in the morning over to Exeter. And then I had decided on this trip. I was like, hey, Steve, you've been over to the UK enough times now. You know, you always got in an automatic. It's kind of embarrassing. You know, you got to get yourself a manual shift, dude, and really see what it's about. So I put in for a manual, and, you know, they took care of the rest. And this airport, you know, you've kind of got to, like, go outside and walk around and across the road and things to this teeny, tiny, completely packed parking lot full of rental cars. Like, everything is almost touching. Here it would be a driveway, but there it is a several lane parking lot. It's just different. And I get, you know, this the probably one of the biggest vehicles on the lot. I think they figure I'm American, so I'm going to want some giant thing. Here it would be a smart car, but there it was like a minivan, and it was a Citroen something. I don't remember. And I had never driven one of these before, so I was curious, okay, where's the clutch going to be? Where's first gear going to be? So to answer your questions, the clutch is on the left, and first gear is in the same place it normally would be. But it's on your left arm, you know, and so it's way, way, way over to the left. So if you have a neck injury in particular and are going to England, I highly recommend you get an automatic vehicle. Hey, there you go. There's one of my first travel tips. But no, that is the nature of this. I'm trying to share things that are useful. Because when you're sitting, think how much time you spend with your, at least me, with my driving habit and my left hand in that case on the gear shift, and your right hand on the steering wheel. You're kind of like an ape, hanging with your arms open. And these trips, they really destroyed me, pain wise. Not to mention, did I mention how small everything is over there? I mean, the two-lane roads, you have to, some of them, I'm not kidding, you have to fold your mirrors in to get through the hedges. I mean, this is ridiculous. I don't know how they make it work. But I know they're equally, many are as scared as I am. As scared as I am over there, they're as scared as, they're that scared when they come over here. So at least, you know, that makes me feel kind of good. But anyway. Not all, definitely not all. There are people, you know, much more skilled than myself, obviously. But anyway, get the automatic if you've got neck problems in England. But honestly, if you can just take a cab or, I don't know, a burrow or however, this really car is not the most practical way to get around England. I would recommend you do that. But anyway, it is a little more daunting on fentanyl. Really. And, yeah, so just getting the, vehicle out of the parking lot is, you've got to like slide a card or enter a code or something. I can't remember, but you've got to go through a little gate and, oh man, it's tight. It is a small parking lot and this is, you know, a standard on the other side of the, on the side, which is not right. Well, actually the steering wheel's on the right, but anyway, it was interesting. Go down this little teeny tiny road that goes to the airport hotel and get my hotel for the evening. It's a nice hotel room, a handicap room on the ground floor, and left out in the morning and went off and conducted my business a day later, whatever, came back, go to my room, tired, exhausted, hungry. Just found out the restaurant next door is closed. Swipe my card. Key won't open the door. I go to the front desk and ask them, you know, if they could redo my key. It had forgotten because I had to redo my reservation. They said, oh, Dr. Coleman, we're sorry. You didn't have a reservation for tonight. We had to remove your things from your room. The hotel is full, so we tried to find you a room here in town, which we could not. Everything is full. And at our sister hotels, one town away, we're all full. So what we recommend is that you get in your car and drive 45 minutes down the road here and begin looking on the road for no vacancy signs. Okay, so that sucked, and I pretty much knew, I didn't drink while I was on fentanyl because you're so close to consciousness. But that required a cider. I may have had two. And I sat down in the bar. I think I was there pretty early, though. That's what it was. I had gotten there like 3 o'clock, and I just, I was half considering and probably would these days just sleep in the car. But I was in a great deal of pain. So anyway, back to fentanyl time period and back to jolly old far southern England in Somerset. Beautiful part of rural part of England, so pretty. But I'm in a little town, and I pull in, I get things taken care of the room, and this is another, I mean, England, with the chain hotels and stuff, chain business hotels, it's even worse and more soul-sucking than the US. It's definitely just as bad. I think they both get their hard-boiled eggs from the same place in China, and I mean, it's all just so generic, and it's rugged. But they had an Indian restaurant that delivered to this hotel, and the little bar, it didn't even, I'm in cider country, and the bars at the hotel don't even carry the local cider. I mean, it's just embarrassing. It just sucks. It just sucks. But they did have an Indian restaurant that delivered, and I got like $100 Indian food or $50 Indian food, and sat there and ate it in the lobby. Then I went upstairs. This is the second day of my patch. I was in a heck of a lot of pain at this point. So I, went up, and I always like to take a shower and then put my patch on, get that area under the patch clean and everything. It's always so gross. Patch is only, the size, well, at this point it was a 25 mic patch, and it was the size of, what is that square? 2 inches square, maybe? Okay. So first, I want to find my patches, so I go to get the coat that they're in, and I'm like, oh man, where is that coat? Did I leave it in the car? Negative. I left it in the bar, 45 minutes away from here, one way, at an exit that I always miss, and did again. So I overshot and drove another 5 miles and turned around. This is rural England. This is not, downtown London. Turned around, came back. In the bar of the full hotel where I was, were, German flight crews, hanging out drinking, loudly. Young. These are small little planes. It's pretty hopping crowd. If it would have been a different time and I was a different person, maybe I would have joined them. Anyway, my coat was still there, thankfully. It hadn't been touched, and I checked to make sure that its payload of narcotics, of Valium and fentanyl, were in it as well. So generally, I would keep my stuff in the room safe, but if I ever felt like that room safe wasn't all that secure, I would carry it directly on me. And a lot of places, like Turkey, didn't have a room safe. But these patches are small. You can also hide them, maybe. I mean, they're, I'm not trying to give you advice on how to smuggle fentanyl, that's for sure. I would give you advice to just stay away from fentanyl. It doesn't really have any purpose that an anesthesiologist, that anyone other than an anesthesiologist needs. So that's how I feel about that drug. But I do feel it is a very useful and necessary drug. So where I'm in England. And yeah, I'm driving in this huge vehicle on these little teeny tiny freaking roads, in a manual transmission vehicle on fentanyl at like 1 in the morning. Now my fentanyl is pretty faded at that point. I'm in a lot of pain. I'm in a lot more pain than I am in fentanyl. The fog from the pain is just as heavy as the fog from the fentanyl, pretty much. I mean, colors and everything were different on fentanyl, and it just suppresses your central nervous system so much that you live in a pretty dull life when you're on that mess. It's a pretty bleak existence. I pity anyone that has to be on it involuntarily. And I know how devastating it is. when it still doesn't take care of your pain. But I was in a time of fentanyl back in England. And I drove back to the hotel, and I put the patch on, but obviously didn't sleep that night, because I never slept the night. The day you put the patch on, you can't sleep. But I was all jet lagged, you know, I'm all messed up because I'm about to catch a plane back to the States. And I wasn't going to sleep anyways, so it didn't really matter. It was like, I just eat this Indian food and go up there with a full belly. And so, I don't know, if anybody out there has problems with fentanyl or opiates keeping them awake, but you still got to be on them because you're in pain, and you're, you know, listening to me going, man, I kind of know what he's talking about. I eventually developed a way to, I would just close my eyes and I would go completely silent everywhere, turn, you know, no clocks ticking, nothing. Put in earplugs, whatever you need to go completely, you know, no sensory input, and close your eyes and just meditate. And I did that for about the last, you know, 8 months. And it becomes a skill that you can use, and you can add with other skills. When you have control over your sleep, and you have control over your pain, and you have control over your hunger, because you can go days without eating, these all begin to be skills that, they're survival skills in the most basic sense. And they are important to getting through. At least they've been important to me. I'm not trying to tell you what's important for you. I am trying to tell you what's been important for me. It's been a lot of things. It has been many things, any one of which missing, this would not have happened. I would not be better. I would not be telling you these stories right now. The reason why I'm telling the travel stories, it's a little tough for me to talk in a lot of detail about the times on fentanyl. But I describe it, I think, pretty well in that LinkedIn article. So if you would find me on LinkedIn, my name is Stephen Michael Coleman, PhD. I am a laser engineer. So if you just search like Stephen Coleman Cannabis Laser, my LinkedIn posts and articles. There's only 5 articles. I'm not trying to drive any traffic to monetize anything here, guys. It's just that this is... it's very hard stuff to deal with. I don't have a full support system right now. So it already takes a lot of work to bring you these shows and access the most difficult times in my life. It's a little bit much right now. But I'll get there. And we all know that it's a process. It's day by day. And here's to another day of getting through. Thank you guys for listening so much. So what happened was, you're not supposed to be in any environment greater than 77 degrees, I believe it is. You're not supposed to sleep with any kind of heating blanket or too warm, anything like that, or take any kind, even a warm shower. You're supposed to take a cool shower. you know, I like a hotter shower, and I wanted to just see, I mean... I could feel from the steam and stuff, you know, I felt a little bit woozy, like just getting that extra heat circulating around you, kind of just already, any kind of warming up, you could feel it, and it would, you know, your intoxication on that patch was really sort of temperature dependent, in a way, you know, as you moved around. But whenever the warm water, I just passed it under the warm water as I rotated underneath the spout. I did it intentionally though, but, you know, as quickly as you can without going crazy intentionally. And I just collapsed in the tub, I guess. I didn't feel it. And I woke up, my face is all smashed into the ground. I'm like, my neck's all twisted, and I'm like, what's pushing on my face? And I slowly kind of wake up, you know, become conscious. And here I am in the bathtub, all crumpled up on the floor, and luckily the water's not spraying on the patch, but it straight up knocked me down. And that, so that was before, you know, I got these other patches that had a liquid in them that I talk about in that article. And those were oval shaped, and I talk about it. The liquid would flow into the shape of the oval, right? So you could either point the oval toward the ground or, you know, perpendicular to the ground, or parallel to the ground, excuse me, as you're standing. Or whatever way, you know, I mean, you could see how it's done. And I found that I needed, you know, the heavier medication during the day, so I turned it to where it would be parallel to the ground whenever I was standing. But what happened whenever you get out of bed for the first time with that thing on, you know, and all that fluid rushes down in and spreads out through the width of the patch, you know, as you get this sudden dose of more. And the first time it happened, my window was open. It was like the summertime, I think. This is New Hampshire. Sleep with the windows open. And my bed, you know, was only like a 2 foot wide little walkway to the against a couple of windows. And I stood up and just like fell over, like right into the windows. I almost went out. Luckily, you know, it's just a one story house, but I didn't actually leave the house. But it freaked me out. It was scary. And that happened, you know, again the next day, almost as severely, and a few other times, but, I kind of got used to it, and I would kind of prepare myself to where I can maintain consciousness. You know, I'd have to stand there for a second and take that shot of